listening to New England Public Radio News, and this is the shortlist NEPR's Week in Review. With us today, Dave Eisenstatter, editor of the Valley Advocate, and Ron Chmielis, columnist with the Springfield Republican. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Hello.
Expanded passenger rail service between Springfield, Hartford, and New Haven is set to begin in the coming days. Additional Amtrak service will get going this weekend on what's being called the Hartford Line, and then next week a new Connecticut-run service will begin. All told, there will be about a dozen trips each way on weekdays, which is double the current number. Andy Patel runs a convenience store at Springfield's Union Station. He hopes the new service will boost his business.
We're going to open. We extended our time, I mean. So definitely more crowd and more business, I mean.
Dave, is this going to work?
Well, I think this is really exciting. As someone who took that Amtrak train between Brattleboro, Vermont and New York City way back when, before I had a car, it's an expensive trip. And these additional trips are going in at much more reasonable prices. I think that to get to New Haven from Springfield, that only sets you back about $12 or $13. If you want to go on from there to New York City, I think it winds up being about $30. That's a lot less than the $50 or $60 it would take you on the regular Amtrak line. That's really exciting for people.
Ron, certainly this can help commuters between all of these cities, but with the casino opening, could this also be an attractive way to bring visitors into Springfield?
Well, it does dovetail well with that. The only thing that makes me nervous about this is the word double. They're doubling that. That's a big change in terms of how much volume you have to do. But I think the concept is good. I think you're right about the casino. I think it's the right time for this.
With less than a month before retail sales of marijuana become legal in Massachusetts, state regulators have announced where the first batch of applicants looking to go into business are located, and so far, not many are in Western Mass. There's just 10 applications for pot shops in the four Western counties, compared to 16 in all of Worcester County. Cannabis Control Commission head Steve Hoffman.
6 months, 12 months from now, if we're seeing some communities that seem to be underserved, that will be a concern, but I'm not concerned at this early stage.
Ron, do the relatively low numbers in Western Mass surprise you?
Well, I don't know what to make of that. To be perfectly honest with you, obviously there's bigger money in the eastern part of the state because there's more people. I think some communities out here have been a little balky about the whole marijuana concept, but we're still early in the game, so I'm not drawing any conclusions about those numbers.
Dave, going off of what Ron said, is this a bit of a wait-and-see approach perhaps by some of these prospective business owners looking to sell retail marijuana, or are they just still working behind the scenes with cities and towns for approval?
It is interesting. I think a lot of the dynamics around this are related to the federal government's position on marijuana, which it's still illegal as a federal law. Elizabeth Warren and Republican Senator Cory Gardner in Colorado had a joint bill to kind of make the federal law line up with whatever the states have decided, so the states get their own way to regulate. And I think that there is a wait-and-see approach because of some degree that confusion around is it legal, is it illegal, and how comfortable is it going to be to do business as a marijuana proprietor.
Ron, what do you think of Senator Warren's bill?
Well, I think it's probably a realistic approach on her part, but I don't think it's going to get too far. She's trying to budge the federal government. I just don't think she's going to do that. I don't think anybody's going to do that, including a Republican from Colorado. I can understand her attempt to try, though she represents Massachusetts.
Dave, you reported this week in the Valley Advocate that some voters feel the growing number of write-in candidates for the state Senate seat formerly held by Stan Rosenberg could be a product of gender bias. Chelsea Klein is the only candidate with her name on the ballot due to Rosenberg's resignation. Tell us more.
Well, you have these five write-in candidates, four of which are men. There has been a lot of chatter about that Rosenberg was in this race, he resigned, and then as soon as he resigns, a number of people, mostly men, again, and not everyone's a male candidate, but a lot of people are seeing some gender bias. As soon as the establishment male incumbent is out of the way, a lot of people are in their view, going after this progressive woman candidate that they see as much more vulnerable. A lot of people see gender bias in this, and I think to some degree there's a longing for there to be a better equity among men and women in the state legislature. There's only 25% women in all the state legislature, and a lot of the women in particular that I spoke to for this story are really looking to not only get a candidate they want that that lines up with their ideals, but also get a woman in there to try to balance that out.
Ron, what do you think about all of this?
With all due respect, and he wrote a great, complete, fair story. I think it's absurd. When we get to the point where men are being discouraged from running, the reason they're write-ins is because of the timing of Rosenberg's exit that nobody really could have anticipated. Women are underrepresented. Chelsea Klein says she's going to go on and make the case to be the best candidate. That's democracy. I think this is good that so many people are running, and nobody's talking about Joe Comerford. Who's going to tell her she doesn't have the right to run? I think men and women have the right to run for office.
And in speaking of democracy, this week lawmakers in Massachusetts started working to hammer out a compromise bill which could end up requiring civics education in public schools. The House and Senate have passed separate bills already. Ron, you teach a social studies class at a local Catholic school which would not be affected by this law, but is it necessary?
Well, I think it would be affected indirectly, and I do think a law is necessary. I think a new push towards civics could be done, has to be done without taking away from other courses. The debate now in Boston is should it be mandated or more or less voluntary. And the question is, if you don't mandate it, will different communities do it differently or at all? But I hope something comes out of this because we do need to know more about our own government and ourselves.
Dave, should it be the lawmakers who are trying to require schools to teach civics, or should this be left up to education officials?
I'm always a little bit skeptical about trying to cram more into the curriculum and having more be required and done to the test. I think that that educators can make up their own minds about what they're teaching their students. At the same time, I agree that civics is very important, and I think that that should be a part of the mix.
All right, Dave Eisenstatter of the Valley Advocate and Ron Chmielis of the Springfield Republican newspaper, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thank you, our loyal listeners of The Shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review. And remember, you can catch us at any time wherever you get your podcasts or at nepr.net/podcast. I'm Adam Frenier, and this is New England Public Radio.